Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Simplexity of Design Netcast. My name is Alexandre Joyce, and I'm an industrial designer doing the master's program in design and complexity at the University of Montreal. As always, you can follow along with the website at conscienceDesign.ca/blog. This week's entries, we'll be talking about value in design, the Crowd Spirit Initiative, my new logo, and Herbert Simon, The Science of the Artificial, as seen through the eyes of J.M. Carroll. So enjoy the show. The date is Tuesday, November 28th, 2006. Values in Jeopardy. Alex, I'll take a design for 2000. That's a Jeopardy contestant choosing a category. The researchers of today's article haven't gotten their design category down yet. Everything is everywhere. Which happens to be a good thing, because I myself can become a detached dreamer sometimes. But that's quite all right. This new design point of view is still a work in progress. Starting from the human-computer interface, HCI, design possibilities, Friedman, Kahn, and Borning developed their approach for multiple inspiring and contemporary approaches. In computer ethics, implementations are too single-minded. In social computing, little is said of the design process. In participatory design, the democratic development lacks guidance, which leads to encouraging self-interest. And lastly, in computer-supported cooperative work, the efforts have been too oriented towards the effective workplace. So with those pillars in place, what do the three researchers propose? This is the title of their article, which is Value-Sensitive Design, Theory and Methods. First and foremost, what is value-sensitive design? And I quote, "It's an approach to the design of technology that accounts for human values in a principled and comprehensive manner throughout the design process." To me, this is more than design of a technology. It's an approach to design in general. Nonetheless, I'm quite fond of the methodology that they present as an integrative part of the value-sensitive design. It looks as though they have all the bases covered. VSD is a tripart methodology that involves conceptual, empirical, and technical investigations, employed iteratively. They follow nicely with this description of types of research with three independent design projects. A program that adds on to the open-source Mozilla browser makes the user aware of content to accept internet cookies. They studied our psychological reactions to a plasma screen in an office that shows live feeds of a natural panorama. Finally, they used an urban simulator to shape planning scenarios depending on the participants' values and thus foresee the social consequences. The authors first describe the ideals of value-sensitive design with 7 points. Briefly, it seeks to be proactive, taking part early in the design process. It can reach out to more than just the workplace, to education, to urban planning, to online communities. Number 4 on their list is that it includes all moral values. They say that values encompass participation, democracy, and collaboration. That's where value-sensitive design starts to seem utopian or naive. But more importantly, the authors follow up by asking the very questions I was asking myself. What are values? How should these values be supported in the design process? And how does the tool manage the values? The answers were supposed to come in the conceptual investigations. In this case, they focused on trustworthiness of the web. They fully understood the consequences of actions on people's views of trust and their expectations of the system. The next step is an empirical evaluation of the findings. My personal interest for the work of the researchers is in the questions they ask. Although I don't believe that values are what need to be integrated into the design process, I prefer to speak of intentions. This is because, to me, intentions are values put to use. On the other hand, a strong point was made when speaking of how organizations are addressing groups and therefore the values included in the design are multiplying. Therefore, and I quote, "How do the designers bring values into consideration and into the process to generate increased value, employee satisfaction, customer loyalty, and other desirable outcomes?" I'll take sustainability for 2020, Alex. The date is Thursday, November 30th, 2006. Spirited crowdsourcing. I've noticed a new trend in Web 2.0. I've been reading so many blog posts that I've finally put my finger on it. I'm calling this publicity parasites. People are searching on the internet to find themselves. And that's fine. Then when they find some blog entry about themselves, usually as a good example, the person comes in and writes a comment to say thank you. That's also fine. However, this is becoming a new form of light publicity. Every time I read about crowdsourcing, there's a message for this next initiative called CrowdSpirit. Admittedly, the method works. I found out about CrowdSpirit by reading the comments in a Business Week article. Nonetheless, the CrowdSpirit is a fine initiative. Its motivations are in grassroots, user-generated solutions. Where's the fun of letting consumers consume? Why not let consumers become prosumers? Let them get involved in the process. I find the process that they describe to be quite evocative because of the well-defined roles that the community members can play. Starting with the inventor that sends in the ideas and solutions to the contributor's problem. Then all contributors can vote on the ideas at hand. The investors will have a chance to fork out some dough to finance the development of the product. The product then goes into the prototyping and evaluation phases with the testers. Then the production gets underway as the ambassadors promote the products to retailers. And supporters help with the customer experience. The initial focus of the CrowdSpirit initiative is to create technological products. One of the motivations for this choice of market entry is that the large companies don't take into account the end-user expectations. Sony should keep their eyes and ears open. For now, CrowdSpirit is putting a $190 price tag limit on their eventual gadget. An important note is that the patents and royalties of the intellectual property will be shared by the community. Now here are some open-ended questions. How can the financial rewards reflect the evolution of ideas during collaboration? What kind of people are building on each other's ideas? And what happens when the people will come to voting? And on what standards do you evaluate every entry individually? Or is there an organized competition to better compare the possibilities? And what happens if the crowd ends up voting for something that doesn't have a marketable appeal? Or what happens if the expectations are much greater than the technological and financial possibilities? How open-sourced are the ideas and designs? Will the Creative Commons licenses be applied? How do you fight copycats and Asian rip-offs? Can they be included in the process instead? Can the investor end up buying the whole process? This is all very exciting. I can't wait to see how the idea submission interface will look like, and how the voting will take place. What's the crowd's feel going to be? And tell me, when do we start? The date is Monday, December 4th, 2006. I love my new logo. It's the world premiere of my new company logo. Let me share a few arguments and justifications of how it came about after 3 years in the making. First of all, the typography seems special, yet really, it's just something old with a twist. The Georgia font was created for use on computer screens as it is easily scalable in a pixelated context, which means that this logo can be present just about anywhere you can write text. This is great for emails and other text applications. What I find incredible is that the font looks so different in italics. As for the bold emphasis on the word conscience, it's simply to differentiate the two words as they are closely set to each other. A small touch of creativity was added in the letter G. As you can see in the normal font of Georgia, the G is actually special. However, in the italic version, the G gets quite boring. This is a personal choice. I find the style for the G more eye-provocative. So the G is actually a larger Times New Roman version in italics. But let's keep that secret between you and me. The almost junction of the two words is purposely calculated to give the feel that it's one single idea. Similar to when you have thoughts in your head.
This idea of thoughts and consciousness is also present in the use of accolades. Everything between two accolades represents a stream of consciousness, which ties into James Joyce's style of writing. Finally, these same accolades also evoke the faces of people. So therefore, what's in between the faces could be these thoughts, but also the people's consciousness. Finally, another interpretation may be that the two faces are actually one single person, as the ideas go from the subconscious to the conscious. The final idea behind this logo is to make it fade into its context. Depending on the use and function, it's going to be fun to play with the contrasts. Once again, this is to convey the idea of subconsciousness, and maybe a wink to the no-logo school of thought. The logo is present, but sometimes you have to look deeper to see it, or even change your angle of view to see it on the screen. Of course, the standard black and white version is also very sharp for letterheads or contexts that require a better read. The date is Monday, December 11th, 2006. Simon Says, Part 1. I was reading Herbert Simon's Science of the Artificial, and let me tell you, it's a heavy read. I think that it might be due to the fact that Simon was a precursor and that he wrote ahead of his time, and thus, not very concretely. Indeed, Simon's central premise is that humans try to control the natural world by designing the artificial world. It just so happens that I fell upon this article called Dimensions of Participation in Simon's Design by J.M. Carroll. This researcher focuses on the participation of users in the design process as understated in Simon's point of view on design. Basically, Carroll dissected the science of the artificial and proposes 8 aspects of participatory design that aren't explicitly, but that are implicit to Simon's thoughts. For example, Simon speaks of active people taking charge of their future and thus becoming designers of some sorts. And I quote, "The members of an organization or a society for whom plans are made are not passive instruments, but are themselves designers who are seeking to use the system to further their own goals." The further I would read the article, the more I wondered if this was Carroll's point of view seeing the world through Simon's glasses, or if it was Simon's world with Carroll's glasses. In retrospect, I think it's Simon's world through the eyes of Carroll's, and I'm the one wearing glasses. This understanding of the point of view is important because when it comes to defining participation, who's the one to cite? As Carroll admits, and I quote, "There is no direct discussion of participatory design in the sciences of the artificial, but there are some clear hints of Simon's sympathies." Nonetheless, in this article, participatory design is defined as, and I quote, "A term that refers to a large collection of attitudes and techniques predicated on a concept that people who ultimately will use a designed artifact are entitled to have a voice in determining how the artifact is designed." Already I feel that there are many more citations to come in this entry. Carroll is great at proposing interesting thoughts on elements of participation and sitting down those concepts on a heavy citation of Simon. If it wasn't for Carroll's focused interpretation, Simon just seems vague. But is Carroll making Simon sound like he was saying something he actually wasn't? What are Simon's sympathies with participation? The date is Tuesday, December 12th, 2006. Simon Says, Part 2. In retracing the 8 elements and sections of Carroll's article, I tried to retrace as a possible model of the elements that make up participation. We see that there are 3 pulls to social aspects of design. They are identifying stakeholders, human activity, and dynamics of design. You could check out this model at the consciencedesign.ca blog. Design is a part of human activity, as man shapes the artificial world. This leads to the idea of hierarchy. Christopher Alexander explains that systemic design takes into account this hierarchical factor to better deal with contexts and patterns. The complexity of systemic design approach is itself leading to iteration as says Brooks, because the initial decomposition is more or less always wrong. The dynamics of design can be resumed through the multiple facets of participation, as well as the multiple types of input. The results themselves are also dynamic, as they are subject to evolve through the collaboration and the development process. The identification of stakeholders is concerned with the fact that design is reaching out to more people than ever. That's one of the reasons why I'm interested in democratizing design. But don't take my word for it. Simon emphasized, and I quote, that designers must consider the consequences of a design beyond what the client specifies or even cares about, and that a designer has the obligation to act as a teacher and not merely an implementer. Now, I'm well aware of the negatives of opening up the design process to all stakeholders. Politicians say it enough. You can't please all of society. Or as Simon puts it, society always is a client in design, but society itself is multifaceted and replete with conflicting goals and values. And once again, that's where democracy comes in to try to even out the disparities and paradoxes. In the case of too many end users for everyone to participate directly, representative democracy is another avenue for implementing participative design. However, with the avenue of the Internet, quantity is no longer the problem, yet the quality of participation is to be evaluated. Where human activity meets identifying the stakeholders, you have human development. What I mean is that human activities are conducive to learning from the point of view of other stakeholders. Therefore, all humanity gains from the reflexivity in trying to better understand each other's ways. The human activity is understood and acted upon within the process of design. Indeed, the outcome of design tends to accommodate and capitalize from the variety of the human activity. As human activities become more and more complicated, specialization is an ever-growing trend in attacking the problem head-on. However, as human activities also become more and more complex, the larger image and all the different relationships between the elements of the problem needs to be taken in charge. To answer the problem of these two opposites, Simon says, and I quote, people organize their activities through divisions of labor and collaborative dependencies to allow themselves to perform tasks more extensive and complex than any individual could accomplish. All human activity is collaborative, but the structures and processes of each design context are somewhat unique, both with respect to the design requirements and approaches to identifying those requirements. Between design and stakeholders, there's a preoccupation for the intelligibility of design representations. This is a common problem to the participative design process. If end users are to play a significant and continuing role in design, it is crucial to make design activity intelligible to all stakeholders. I've written earlier of this lack of interactivity due in part to the faulty lines of communication. In this design matter, communication amongst participants during collaboration needs to lead to a common understanding before the various types of representations can become a source of inspiration. A quick example to illustrate this. Imagine a software designer proposing software and a group of users trying to understand how to make the problem meet their needs. Simon says, the non-triviality of this gap between the worldview of the software designer and the worldview of the potential user of the software is one of the motivations for participatory design. The question is, how do users communicate those needs for the software designers to create better interfaces? Carroll submits a few possibilities for common ground amongst participants. First is scenario building. This is where the user is the director of the scene and he is forced to reflect on how he is going to suffice to his needs. And Carroll sees even more in this approach. And I quote, because all stakeholders are able to create stories of envisioned user experiences, scenario-based design allows for non-designers to participate as creators as well as critics. The second possible means of common communication is prototypes, as they provide an evolving framework for exploring design options and gradually focusing on a final solution. Prototypes, or the proper term maquettes, also represent a physical incarnation or even explanation of ideas. The last, and to me the most interesting common ground for communication amongst participants, is organizational models. This is another example of the use of mind mapping software. What's important here is that the representation is required to assure all parties understand the relationships between the different elements. It's a level understanding field that helps the participants conceptualize and therefore creates a common point of view of the problem. Again, this is a point that I've tried to make earlier, stating that participatory design might lead to designing services more than designing products. The date is Wednesday, December 13th, 2006. Simon says, Part 3. Although I've spoken often of how others approach the subject of participation in design, I propose that we plunge back into Carroll's inductions of Simon's thoughts. At the center of the illustration is participation in design, describing it as an emergent phenomenon, possible only within the relationships of the dynamics of design, the human activity, and the stakeholders. And that's my editorial view. I based this on the fact that Carroll touches all the bases when he speaks of meaningful user participation in design. To achieve this requires that the discourse constituting the design activity be accessible to all stakeholders. Carroll defines participatory design as, and I quote, the direct inclusion of users within a development team such as that they actively help in setting design goals and planning prototypes. Note once again that all three pillars are included in this view. However, I beg to differ when he states that participatory design is also called cooperative design. I believe that there is such a distinction. For example, while using the MTurk service, people are participating in the design but not collaborating with each other. I can hear some critics say that technically, because they're not implicated in the decision-making, they're not really participating. To that I answer that participation takes many different forms, even more so over the internet. Even when viewing a blog, this is somewhat participating, although passively. This brings up one of the premises for my own work. How can users actively participate in decision-making in the design process over the internet? The title of the illustration is Social Aspects of Design. This is in the sense that design is an accumulation of many fields. This transdisciplinarity of practices mixed with the ever-growing power of technology makes the design reach out to more people in more ways. Simon argued, and I quote, that designers must always be concerned with consequences beyond the client's directly articulated concerns. Therefore, might I suggest the idea that one of the objects of design is society itself. I believe that we are no longer asking the question, how can things be done, but why should things be done? This leads to participation of the stakeholders in society, which in turn allows for the design to auto-regulate the evolution of society. In other words, participation is just one of the ways that design is interacting with the social sciences. Another question is, how does that interaction take place? Simon says that that interaction will take place through the communication during the design as a project for society. First of all, he sees design as a level playing field, a lingua franca for people. He even characterizes the science of design as a core discipline for every liberally educated person. Imagine that for the next school reform. Imagine Mrs. Robinson as your fourth grade homeroom and design teacher. It's true that with all that specialization taking place in various fields, there has to be a way of bringing people back to the table. I feel that so far in the post-industrialization period, the common language has been money. The common language could become values, and the grammar of this language is design. When it comes to design projects, I often find myself in the following situation. I start by defining a direction, for example, heading for space. Then I realize that I need to aim for the stars. Finally, I end up on the moon. Simon argues that the role of design goals is to evoke and focus activity, which results in the identification of further design goals. So, 13 weeks into my master's subjects, I can say that crowdsourcing was the launch towards the stars. These far-out stars are actually some future form of design democracy. Finally, I feel that the accessible moon is going to be a wiki. This idea of democracy and implied participation ties in with the impacts of design on the fabrics of society. Once again, this calls for a generation of responsible designers. This next generation of responsible designers is in turn going to be in charge of a new generation of needs, solutions, and even more problems. However, as I alluded to earlier, I don't think the designers will be solely responsible for the evolution of society itself. That would imply that the future world is designer-centered. In contrast, the role of the designer is to revolutionize the current system for society to create its own evolution. The paradigm shift of design profession could go from generating solutions for people's problems to making people owners of the problem so they can generate the solution themselves. And on that reoccurring theme, we conclude this edition of the Simplexity of Design netcast. My name is Alex Joyce. Thank you for listening, and you're always welcome to send in comments or suggestions at joyce@consciencedesign.ca. And we'll see you next week.